Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. Once again, it's another outstanding episode of America's Most Haunted. And we are joined by a fellow Ohioan. All the more exciting. Buckeyes United. Oh, you're way down there by Kentucky. But no, that's okay. In fact, both of my older children went to the University of Cincinnati. And by the way, I'm Eric Olson, and with us this evening is John the Ghost Hunter Kachuba. I hope I pronounced that right.
You did.
Excellent. And of course, as always, my co-host, the world famous haunted housewife, Teresa Argy. Teresa, tell us about John, since you guys are all pals and whatnot, writing about each other and all that.
That's right. And, you know, I also went to University of Cincinnati, just to throw that in there. One of my many turns in college. I should be a frickin' doctor all the years I spent in college. But tonight we have John Kachuba, America's Most Haunted, is proud to welcome the extraordinary author, ghost hunter, John Kachuba. John's most recent book is Ghost Hunting Ohio, On the Road Again, the follow-up to his first paranormal book, Ghost Hunting Ohio. He's also the author of Ghost Hunting Illinois and the editor of the America's Haunted Road Trip series, which is awesome. Not to be confined geographically or otherwise, John also wrote Ghost Hunters on the Trail of Mediums, Dowsers, Spirit Seekers, and Other Investigators of America's Paranormal World in 2007, the longest book title ever. It's a collection of America's haunted hotspots with some of the most notable people in the paranormal today. But he's no one-trick pony. No, sir, not John, former professor at the uber-haunted Ohio University. He writes paranormal fiction as well. He recently released Dark Entry and Ghost Stories, available on ebooks for Kindle. John joins us tonight. You've probably heard him on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, Jim Harrell's Paranormal Podcast, and tonight on America's Most Haunted. Welcome, John Kachuba.
Wow, what a welcome. Thank you.
That was a mouthful, wasn't it?
I know. I didn't recognize that guy. So who is
I have one question, John.
Uh-oh, just one? It'll be a short interview, but go ahead.
What happened to Indiana?
What happened in Indiana? Well, actually, we kind of jumped over that one, didn't we? We went from
Ohio
to Illinois. Exactly.
You pole vault in Indiana.
Well, you know what happened, actually? It's funny that you say that, because there were actually two books about Indiana written by Wanda Willis. And they actually were the nucleus for the America's Haunted Road Trip series. They were published, I don't know, probably 20 years ago. And a publisher thought, hey, I really like these books and they're doing well. What if we expanded it to the Midwest? And so we did. And then those are doing well. So what if we expanded it nationwide? And so we did that. So Indiana started the whole thing, actually. So there you go.
Wow.
Hard to believe, I know.
That is amazing. Well, we have friends in Chicago. We drive over. We try to go once a year, but you know how that goes. We don't always make it. But that jaunt across northern Indiana is always chock full of excitement.
Well, okay, that's one way to put it, yeah. I wasn't thinking of excitement, but okay, sure, why not? We'll go with that.
Well, how did you, what I'm interested in is, I mean, here you have all of this achievement. You're a man of achievement, obviously,
wow.
Especially in the writing front and whatnot. How did you sort of leapfrog or parallel, I guess is more what it is, combining your interest in the paranormal with writing? Which came first, or were they parallel?
No, actually, I mean, I've always considered myself a writer. You know, ever since I was literally 10 years old and handwriting a newspaper for the kids on my block, you know. I mean, that's when I started writing. And so I've written all my life. And I've always had an interest, though, too, in the paranormal, and not just ghosts, but sort of, you know, metaphysical paranormal subjects generally. And growing up in New England, especially where I did, I always heard a lot of ghost stories and all that kind of stuff up there, too. So that just kind of, you know, was grist for the mill, so to speak. But I didn't really start writing about this stuff until I had the occasion to meet Ed and Lorraine Warren. And, of course, you know, your audiences, I'm sure, know those names. Of course, Ed has since passed away, but Lorraine is still out there doing her thing, you know, with the paranormal. I lived in the same town that they did for a while and actually went to their house a couple times, and we exchanged photos and, you know, stories and things like that. And they really got me more interested in the idea of actually maybe even writing about it, because they had a few books out at that time already. And so that was, you know, kind of in the back of my mind to do it. But even then, it took a while. It didn't. The first ghost book didn't come out until 2004. And then the last three came out, you know, pretty quickly after that, rapid succession. But it took me a while to start writing about it. And now I'm actually working in paranormal fiction. So for young audiences as well as for, you know, adults too. So that's the Kindle books that Teresa mentioned are both paranormal that are on Kindle at this point.
Oh, they're great too. That Dark Entry was great. That was a quick read. I downloaded that. I think I had it read in 2 days. So it was great. I had to borrow my daughter's Kindle, but it's nice. It's nice to have that. It's immediate access. You know, I love the book, though. As much as the e-book craze seems to be the wave of the future, I love holding the book in my hand. But it is nice to have that, especially if you're glued to your technology like people are these days.
Right.
But it's just a testament to your talent, John, that you can do fiction and nonfiction. And like I was mentioning to Eric, you also are just a writer in general. You're not just like, I am a paranormal investigator who's now turning to writing. You're a writer. So in the team of Eric and I, he's more the journalist and the writer, and he's kind of helping me along and develop my writing skills. And I'm the paranormal person. I'm kind of bringing him into my world. So we're like a very dysfunctional match made in heaven when it comes to writing the book we're writing. But, you know, I'm striving to be a better writer, and I'm trying to get Eric into becoming more of an investigator. But you can do it all. And you've been to some of these amazing places, and you've been to some of the places that we have in our book, America's Most Haunted, that's coming up. You've been there. I've been there with you. The Ohio State Reformatory was and Eric's been there as well. One of my absolute favorite places in the world, and not just because it's geographically close, but we had some experiences there.
Yeah, I remember we had, I think Jackie Williams was with us that
Jackie.
Night.
Yeah, and, great. And Michelle Bellanger was with us.
Right, Michelle. That's right. That's right. And I remember Jackie walking along that one cell block and just literally pointing out inmates as we're going by, you know, like, oh, there's a guy sitting there with a pack of cigarettes under his sleeve, and there's a fat guy over here, and he's not too happy. And I was floored by that because, I mean, do you remember that? She just kind of walked down the cell block, and like, oh, this guy. I was like, wow. You know, it was like amazing, you know.
It's like she could see something we couldn't, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That place is really incredible. I haven't been back since. I'd like to go back there again sometime. But it was really, yeah, that's a pretty incredible place, I have to say.
How fortunate for me you have chosen to speak about the the Ohio Reformatory, since that is the only place that I have actually sort of investigated. Well, that's not true. When I met Teresa and the Haunted Housewives, we went on a little investigation up in Willoughby, and that was very fun and interesting. We got some results, and we have subsequently, because now we're on chapter two, you've also named our first chapter, and that was, you know, that's the one that's written. That was the one that the book proposal for America's Most Haunted was based upon. So, boy, oh boy, do we know the Ohio Reformatory. But, yeah, now we're working on the Knickerbocker. Have you been there?
You know, I have not, and I'm hearing a lot of good things about that, so I'd like to see what you come up with.
It could not be much more different. You're talking about diametrically opposed places, physically, mentally, emotionally, and seemingly even ghostily, if that's a word. If it isn't, I just made it up. Yay, me. I coin words like Shakespeare. So, yeah, I mean, it's a private place. It's been a hotel. It is not open to the public. I guess it really hasn't been a functioning hotel for a number of years. It's kind of passed from hand to hand. But now it's been restored by the Knickerbockers, the couple that owns it. And it really is this kind of amazing period piece from the Gilded Age. And the level of activity, I mean, compared to, you know, an enormous building, multi-wings and tiers, and a place that tens and thousands of people have been through under strong emotional duress like the reformatory. This is, you know, maybe it's 20 rooms total, much smaller, much just completely different, and yet it is extremely active. I mean, we've seen some evidence, and of course, Teresa's gathered her own. She has some great stories in this chapter as well as the Ohio Reformatory. But, I mean, there's physical, tangible evidence that's just really astonishing. There's the picture of the ghost cat that, I mean, you just almost can't believe, especially because it was picked up off a live internet feed. So it's really just a screen grab. And yet there's the cat. You can see the markings, you can the color, the attitude, the position. It's amazing. And then the ghost, the shadow figure captured up on the third floor by a static IR camera is zowie. It is really quite astonishing. So yes, if you can make it up there, it's kind of it's not nearly as close for you, of course, from Cincinnati, but maybe on the way, if you're heading back to New England, you could go that way. It's really a neat place. So we're having a lot of fun. And also, I did want to address, I didn't want to interrupt her at the time, but Teresa is underestimating herself, because really the book, especially these first chapters, because we're focusing on the places that we, which really means she, know best and have been to the most and have had personal experiences at. I mean, those experiences and those observations and the experience that goes into those observations and the background and the perspective, that's the essence of the book. I mean, I'm just kind of trying to tidy things up, make it as kind of writerly as possible. I mean, I'm more editing than anything. It's fun. I love doing the historical research, and I'm kind of writing around what she's doing. But do not underestimate yourself.
Well,
I can speak from experience to that, too, because I've been in the field with I don't know how many different investigators or how many different, you know, paranormal teams, all across the country, not just in Ohio, but I've worked with them in Florida and Connecticut and Pennsylvania and New Mexico and a lot of places. And I have to say, Teresa, this is, I told you that myself, that, you know, she does a lot of research, a lot of historical research, and really, really gets down to the facts, and it is not swayed by, you know, story and rumor and all that kind of stuff, but really does a very thorough job in researching and investigating. And I admire that, because there's not too many people that do that, which is one reason why, you know, Teresa and I are friends. I respect the way she works. She does a very good job of that. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised what you say. Don't sell yourself short. She doesn't sell herself short. Are you kidding me?
I'm blushing. You've got me blushing now. Well, thank you. Well, I do a lot of historical research because I'm a history geek, but also because I don't have all the fancy equipment that some other ghost hunters or paranormal investigators have. But I've always been, I've always loved history, and I've always loved books, and I love the whole escapism of getting into the history. And, like, our focus, as being one of the Haunted Housewives, our focus is different than a lot of the ghost hunters that are out there. We're not about capturing evidence. We don't really care about capturing evidence because, and you know this, John, nowadays anything can be faked, anything can be reproduced. And so you kind of have to take it on faith when somebody presents something.
Right.
We're more interested in, and which is why I like writing, we're more interested in telling the stories. We're more interested in giving the voice to the dead, to let them speak, to let their lives kind of be retold again so other people can learn from them or experience that or appreciate them. I think that one of the saddest things is when people become forgotten. And that's kind of a legend, even in ghost hunting, that a haunting ceases when somebody stops saying your name. And that's when you're completely forgotten. So I think that the spirits and the ghosts and being a ghost hunter and telling stories and writing about it is a way for these people to be remembered. And one thing about having a book and having it in print, that's there forever. And you know, that lasts a lot longer than just an investigation. So I think it's great. But you have to be a good storyteller. And John is a very good storyteller. And when you read his books, it's like you're having a conversation with him. And I love that. Your style is so different than other people's. Michelle Bellanger, one of my very, very favorites. I absolutely love her. She's been a guest on our show, and she's a great, great person to interview. And she's a phenomenal writer. Her writing style is completely different, and she's so intelligent. I always feel stupid around her because she's so smart, but she's not pretentious or anything. But she told me when I started writing that to just write the way you talk, just write very conversationally, write as if you're speaking to somebody, if you're talking to me or if you're talking to your friend Kathy or whoever it is. And so I have to make that balance between writing in a conversational style but still making it interesting. And John, you've got that also now, because your books are just like sitting down with you, having a cup of coffee, and you telling us what happened to you on one of your great adventures. And your books, I love the Ohio books, obviously, because I'm from Ohio, but in your national book, the Ghost Hunters book, you've gone all over. And I know you've had experiences in other countries, too. You've been in Hawaii, and I should tell Eric about some of your experiences in Hawaii and in Taiwan as well. Tell us some of your most fascinating ghost stories outside of Ohio.
Oh, well, Thailand is the one that, it wasn't Taiwan, it was Thailand. But
Thailand, excuse me.
Yeah, no, Thailand was pretty interesting because there was this, I was lucky enough to have been in country for 3 months in Thailand. My wife had gotten a Fulbright appointment to one of the universities there for that time. So while she did all the work, I got to hang out in Thailand and do nothing, which is a pretty good gig, you know.
Yeah.
But I linked up with this with a Thai professor who knew a lot about what was going on. He knew a lot about the history there and everything. And, you know, Thailand was loaded with these palaces that had been built by the various kings over the centuries. Almost every 50 yards is a palace of somebody. But we found, I shouldn't say we found, I guess he kind of did find it. There was this compound. It was an old village that was literally, It was literally walled off. It had a big fence around it, and it was probably about 100-150 years old, and it belonged to the present king of Thailand. It was on palace grounds, but it was not open to the public, and nobody was allowed in there. And yet, we managed, the two of us, to talk to the right people and got ourselves in with a military escort, but we were able to get onto this compound and walk around it and go in these houses. And these are typical Thai houses, which are raised up on stilts. You know, they're thatched and all that stuff and kind of bamboo siding and all. And they probably sit about 10 feet off the ground. But we got to wander through this whole thing. And these homes, as I said, they're about 150 years old. And inside them, a lot of them, there were still piles of clothing. There was some pictures laying around or photographs. There were candles and little models of the Buddha and, you know, different kinds of religious icons and things like that scattered throughout these things. So it was like people just left like yesterday. And it turned out that this place was a village for the people who served the palace. You know, people who did the laundry, you know, people who did the gardening, you know, the peons, you know, and they're kept off the grounds. But it's supposed to be really haunted, and like I say, it's all locked up and secure. And I'll tell you, it was a weird feeling. I took a lot of pictures in there, and I got some very strange sort of anomalies on the film, you know, on the photos that I really couldn't explain. And there's stories of a Thai police officer on a motorcycle that they've seen driving around at night, and he's wearing the uniforms like from, you know, from the early 1900s. And there's no motorcycle, and there's no cop, but they see this guy around there. And there's been a lot of those kinds of sightings. Thailand is really just an incredible place. I was told by the people that if I went out at night, that I should not look into any body of water, you know. I said, why not? They say, well, if you look into the water, there are spirits in the water that will look right back at you and will just take your soul, they say. It'll just take your soul. I said, okay. You know, it's amazing. Oh, yeah, it's amazing. Everybody in Thailand wears some kind of an amulet or a charm or something around their neck, or like women might carry it in their purse, you know, or something like that. There's millions and millions of different kinds of amulets, and they're all designed basically to ward off evil spirits, you know, to bring good spirits and all that kind of stuff. So it's a phenomenal place for ghost hunting, and I want to go back and spend another 3 months there, I think, you know.
I can imagine, and I don't have any experience in this. You have, John. What is the difference between the way a culture like in Thailand, how they approach the paranormal or their acceptance of the paranormal? How different is it than what we have here in the United States?
Well, you know, it really depends on different cultures. But what I found, and I've traveled a lot through, I mean, besides Thailand, I've been in, you know, I spent time in Vietnam and Singapore and Cambodia. And, you know, so I've been through a lot of the Far East. And I think over there, you get a very real acceptance of the spirit world. That nobody thinks twice about whether ghosts exist or not. That's not the question. Of course they do. That's what they say. Of course they exist. There's no question about that. It's what do you do with that? You know, how do you handle that? How do you negotiate your life knowing that, you know, the dead are right beside you? And so there's a lot of different ceremonies, a lot of religious ceremonies that they have, the various countries, and especially in Buddhism. But, you know, throughout the various countries of the Far East where they revere the dead. There's a lot of ceremonies to do that. There's a lot of ceremonies to offer things for the dead. Singapore has what they call a Hungry Ghost Festival. And I forgot how long it lasts. It's a couple of days, but basically people build these or purchase these elaborate paper constructions that they burn in the temple as an offering to the ghost. And what it would be, it'd be like you would buy a maybe 1/8 size model Mercedes, entirely made of paper, right? For your dead ancestor who doesn't have a car in the afterlife. So you buy him a big paper Mercedes and you go burn it in the temple. And they believe that, you know, the ashes, it goes up to the spirit world, and now your ancestor up there has got a Mercedes, and he's quite happy about that, you know? So it's unbelievable, these kinds of things. But the spirit world is very real for these people, and they make no bones about it. Sometimes they have an attitude of, well, they have reverence because it is their ancestors for the most part, you know, but there's also sometimes a fear factor involved. So they do things to kind of, ward off any bad luck or mischance or anything like that from the ghosts. So they do that in temples routinely, you know, give offerings and everything else to protect themselves. Like I say, the Thai wear amulets. So it's a very real part of their lives. And even in Thailand, I was talking to people who were, you know, college professors and everything else, you know, well-educated people. And, nope, you know, you say, let me see your amulet. And the guy will lift up his tie and open his shirt, and there it is, you know. So, yeah, it's very amazing that that's the way it is. So.
Do you think the broader and sounds like near universal acceptance or assumption of the spirit world in Asia, or at least parts of Asia, do you think that is tied in to the general background, the religious background of ancestor worship? Do you think those are connected historically?
Well, I don't know which came first, you know. My guess is, like for instance, ancestor worship, the big cult is in Japan is Shinto. You know, the Shintoists. Buddhists don't do ancestor worship, but they certainly believe, neither do the Hindus, but they certainly believe that their ancestors are in another place, you know, that they are sphere in a spirit world. But they don't necessarily have that reverence for them as they do like in Japan. But I also think, too, that, you know, which came first? It's a good question. I have a feeling that just the belief in something transpiring after death, something eternal transpiring after death, preceded any organized religion. I think the very first caveman, when suddenly his partner drops dead, and he kind of says, you know, I think right away he started thinking, maybe there's something after, there better be something after, or else I'm going to be like him, you know, this inert massive whatever, you know. So I think that belief in an afterlife, I think, probably precedes any sort of formal religious, you know, codification of that. You know what I mean? I think that comes in later. I don't know. I mean, historically, I don't know, but I mean, I'm just guessing here. But to me, it would seem to make sense that that's what happened. But yeah, there's certainly a connection. There's no question that there'd be a connection, I would think, sure.
What is your personal worldview on, I guess, broadly speaking, the paranormal? Where are you approaching it from?
Well, you know, I have to say that I'm probably still looking. And still not exactly sure where. And I'll tell you, Eric, and this probably happened to Teresa, too, I imagine, over the years. You know, your viewpoints change, you know. You're out there doing it year after year and going different places and hearing different stories, and you start thinking about things and analyzing things, and sometimes your view changes. You know, I grew up in a faith that said, oh, yeah, there's definitely an afterlife. There's a heaven and there's a hell, and if you're good, you go to heaven, and if you're bad, you go to hell. But, you know, there's these places, and you live forever. Well, I am no longer, of that religious bent, but I do think that there is something eternal, you know, about us, within us. And I don't know how to describe it other than that. You can call it a soul. You can call it your spirit. I don't care what you call it, but I think there is something that goes on, that transcends what we know about living on Earth. You know, what comes next, I don't know. But I do think that just thinking in terms of science, in terms of, you know, energy, in terms of what Einstein talked about, energy, all the energy of the world being constant or the universe being constant, you know, you can't destroy it, you can't create it, but you can change it from one form of energy to another. Well, we know everything is energy, including ourselves. So what happens when we die? What is that energy that is me? What does that transform into? You know, part of it is pushing up daisies, literally, you know, literally being the molecules that go into a daisy. But part of me, who knows? Maybe there's some other part of me that goes on in some way that still might be maybe conscious or in some state of consciousness, but is more the essence of me, and it's drifting around somewhere in some other realm. So that's a very kind of general way of looking at it. But if you believe that, then I think you can also believe that there's the possibility of perhaps connecting with those people who have already passed on to that way. And you call them a ghost if you want, whatever you want to call them, but the people in another world, you know. So that's sort of my long-winded explanation, you know, but that's kind of what I believe.
Oh, that's not long-winded. Teresa, remember, we had amazing time last week with Gloria Loring, the actress and singer, and I had no idea she was this very deep-thinking paranormal and spiritual writer and whatnot. Anyway, we asked her an opening question, and she talked for 15 minutes.
She's such a sweetie, though. She was really sweet.
She's coming back.
Excellent. She was very articulate and very interesting. And
very articulate.
I didn't think that I was really going to even know what to say to her, because I don't watch her soap operas or anything, but she was actually very sweet. But talking of the question that Eric asked you, John, about religious and your worldview, I grew up in a very, very strict religious upbringing, being Catholic, and again, we were taught the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, there's heaven, there's hell, but then we were also taught that, you know, anything preternatural, anything that is not of this world is bad, and it's evil, it's demonic, it's don't mess with it, blah, 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 and that, of course, just made me want to know more about it, and then having experiences when you're younger, of course, you know, what do you do? You experience something, and you can't even tell your parents about it. But for me as an adult, the more I've done this, the more I've worked in the paranormal, the more it has strengthened my faith, which it seems kind of ironic, but the more I believe in ghosts, because I don't have any doubts, and that's just my personal view. My experiences have given me the belief that I have no doubts that there is an afterlife, that there are ghosts and spirits. I don't believe that everyone I meet who says they've seen a ghost is true. The one thing that I have found, especially this last year, year and a half, since I started writing, and John and Eric, I'm sure you can both attest to this, the more people I meet, the more I realize how much people lie, how they are sometimes outright liars, sometimes they're just completely delusional. So I think that their experiences are not always valid, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. So just because someone says they saw a ghost, they might be lying, but that doesn't mean that ghosts don't exist. And it's hard for me to believe everybody that I meet. And when we're interviewing people for this book, you're like, we had an issue with someone we interviewed for the book who kept changing their story every single time we talked to them. The stories change, the facts change, and it just makes you wonder. So that's why I'm all about the personal experience. I'm glad that I could talk about it openly without being ridiculed or locked up, but, you know, I think that it's the experience is so important, and you have to kind of accept it on faith and take it to what it is. But for me, I think it's fascinating how people strongly believe such different things, even in our own country and then in other parts of the world. They strongly believe what they believe. The reason I asked you about what it was like in another country is because I find that we have to do an international book, Eric, because I find it fascinating how different from culture to culture the spirit world is perceived. And it's, you know, so do ghosts change from person to person, or is it from country to country, or is it just the way they're perceived? I think the whole thing is just absolutely fascinating. They're as different as there are different people in the world.
Well, I think it's true. And I think, you know, the interesting thing about that, Teresa, is when you start looking at ghosts in various cultures, and I've been doing this not just in Asia, but a lot of other places, you know, you see that the ghosts are different. You know,
right?
Like the kind of ghosts you find in America are very typical of what you might find, like if you went to England or, you know, parts of Western Europe, and primarily our foundations were from Western Europe, right? So that makes some sense.
Right.
But you talk about a ghost in South Africa, you talk about a ghost in Japan or something, and they are much different in how they, you know, what they do, how they look, sort of their behavior. And of course, a lot of the ghost lore that goes along with all these different ghosts is different, too. And yet there's some similarities that that you find that, you know, transcends all the cultures and all the, you know, ethnicities. And so you start thinking, well, okay, there are some what appear to be universals. You know, whether they're true or not is hard to say, but there are these universals, which to me sort of gives the whole idea of the ghost maybe a little bit more credence. You know, when people talk about it in the same way and they're, you know, 5,000 miles away from each other or something, you know. So, but, it's a very interesting thing. You know, and your point about sort of people telling you stories and lying and everything, boy, this was something that I had to deal with all my books, you know, because you would get people. Yeah, I mean, the minute you say you're writing a book, and especially in my case when I was writing about places that were open to the public, you know, a haunted restaurant or something. Well, you know, if you're kind of a conniving business person, you might say, well, let's see, are people interested in ghosts? They are. So if I had a haunted bar, would I get a lot more customers? Maybe I've got a ghost, you know. So I had a couple of cases like that where I was interviewing people and I sort of became suspicious of their stories, and maybe they didn't necessarily, like you say, you know, tell three or four versions of it, but some things just didn't hold water, and some of the history that they claimed to have occurred at the location or something actually, you know, never happened. So those people, I just kind of said, well, thanks very much, you know, great story, and did not include them in the book, you know. And hopefully, I haven't been duped by anybody, but, you know, I don't know. It's very possible it may be someplace I wrote about somebody completely conned me. You know, I hope not. I don't think so, but you never really know, do you?
No, you really don't.
Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, I have, as always, I have thoughts on several things that have come up in the last few minutes. Back to the cultural or regional differences between ghosts, I think part of it is the more they're learning about the brain and the more they're learning about the way we actually function in the world, they seem to be learning that more and more the way we perceive the world is in an internal function. It's a function that's going on inside of us. In other words, if we were somehow able to perceive the world as it, quote unquote, really is, apart from our senses, it would be a very different thing. You know, in some ways, it would be kind of like the Matrix, where it's this various these various forms of energy, as you mentioned earlier, and then we have these receptors that then take that information in and interpret it. So I think what part of what we're facing with these differences is simply, you know, cultural differences actually have physical manifestations within us. Our brains are actually trained by the culture and by the language, also by the language, very important, that we speak. And so I think maybe that's part of it. It is literally different. It's not just a kind of a different interpretation, but it's literally different because the modes of perception are different in different cultures and with people who speak different languages. As far as people lying, you know, I have a somewhat of an Asian perspective on that, a Taoist perception on that, in that there are so many gradations, you know, that in the West we see it pretty black and white. Either you're lying or you're telling the truth. In other cultures or in other perspectives, there's a lot of different versions of the truth, and it depends a lot on what you're looking for and what your priorities are. If by truth you want to learn the frame of mind of the person telling the tale, then the wildest fabrication of all time could still have truth in it, whereas the facts as they're being relayed are completely fabricated. So I think part of what we're seeing with these kinds of stories is not necessarily intentional. The person, I believe that Teresa was referring to, I don't think that person is intentionally altering
I
the facts.
I didn't mean that particular person was lying. I just that particular person was just changing the story. I'm just talking in general. I've met people that have just outright lied.
And on purpose, too.
Yes.
Absolutely. And of course, that goes on. And that's the kind of thing that you do want to catch. That's the thing you want to look out for. That's the thing you want to be, you know, aware of. You want to catch people who are intentionally deceiving you. I think a lot of people, though, deceive themselves. Because when you tell a story, you're imprinting it on your own mind. And so it becomes very, and that's another thing as far as just the more they're learning about how brains work. The memory, you know, your memory is very subject to the winds, to being buffeted. You know, there's a lot of things that can happen to memory that are completely unintentional, and you're using a combination of your senses. You're trying to revisualize what happened, and as you're doing that over time, the actual vision that you have, say, of a scenario can actually change over time as the telling kind of, you know, retools or creates kind of a new path through your brain. So, I mean, as I've said before, what's so fascinating to me is the intersection of all these things. I'm personally still wrestling with the line, the barrier, or if in fact there is one, between religion and the paranormal. What is that barrier? What where do they intersect, if at all? I mean, for me, they seem to. But then the also, kind of the other side of the triangle, then is science. You know, what the area where these worlds, these points of view or these worldviews intersect, science, paranormal, and religion, that to me is just endlessly fascinating because clearly they influence each other. And as we learn more from each, that influences our thinking about the others. And I think as far as being an investigator, someone looking for objective truth, this is the absolute golden age with all the equipment that's been developed, a lot of it quite recently, and it is being developed now with so many people being spurred to go out there and investigate by books, by TV, certainly all the explosion of the paranormal investigation TV shows over the last 10 years, but then also all that's being learned about the brain and even to take it into another direction about particle physics. I find it all really astonishing and it's really fun. I have to admit, I was kind of, when I was looking kind of for the next thing to do, I mean, I was kind of casting about, and I've published been the publisher, the entrepreneur behind a series of websites, and I was kind of ready to move on. And, you know, I was just kind of looking around. I thought, you know, this is pretty interesting, and it certainly is popular. But, you know, the more I've got into it, the more important it has become to me, and I've come to really internalize a lot of this. And I now, especially after kind of doing the Twitter account, which is where I'm, you know, scanning all the paranormal stories as they're coming through of all the different kinds, the news and people and talking to people and whatnot, I feel really deeply invested in this now, and I really do find it fascinating.
Well, it's interesting to say that because that's sort of the route that I've taken too. What originally started for me as kind of a more or less a casual investigation in different places, you know, it began with the publisher saying to me, hey, you know, what do you think? How would you like to write these stories about, you know, haunted locations? And I thought, oh, yeah, sounds like fun. You know, sure, why not? I'll try it. I've always been interested in ghosts and history. And so I started off doing that and getting people's stories. And as Teresa said earlier, it is about telling a story. And I think it is all about story. And I do appreciate that comment and the way she's working, because I believe the same thing. That is the way you should approach it. But having said that, just getting into more and more locations, talking to more and more people, and finding out really what their experiences have been, and thinking them through what they possibly might mean, what the ramifications are, and as you said, Eric, their connections. Because I do believe, like you said, that there is. I like the idea of the triangle because I do think there's religion and science and the paranormal, and I think they do intersect someplace. You know, I don't know where that is yet, but I think they do, and I think they will more. I mean, I think we'll find those connections as we start working it. But I do like that. And so for me, what's happened is the whole question of, let's just take the ghost question, you know, what it means. What is a ghost? If we acknowledge that there is something called a ghost, and if it is sort of traditionally as we think, you know, the spirit or the remnant or the soul or whatever of a dead person, well, what does that say for our existence here? What does that say for future existence, future realms? I mean, it opens up an enormous sort of box of questions, you know, and I like that. And I think it's very interesting. And my own work has gotten deeper so that instead of just being concerned with what I call the boo factor, you know? Okay, you go to a ghost house and, oh, wow, it's really scary there was a ghost there. I've gone deeper. I said, okay, there's a ghost. But so what does that mean? What's that all about? Why is it here? What's it here for? What are we supposed to get from this? How does it affect us? What is our relationship to it? And what is our relationship to, you know, the environment that it came from or that we will be in at some point? It's just gotten deeper and deeper. And so I'm writing things now that are much broader than just the issue of ghosts. And it does go into more, I would say, probably spiritual aspects of the idea of, how does God enter into this? Is there a God? How does he enter into it? Are there beings that have always been around, celestial beings? Are there angels? Are there devils? What are they? Do ghosts become those? Yeah, I mean, all kinds of weird, questions to think about. But yeah, it becomes a very fascinating quest, and an important one, I think. Unfortunately, what's happened, or hasn't happened, is that the two other legs of the triangle have been stubbornly refusing to, join up with the third leg there. Physicists, you mentioned particle physics, and I've been reading a lot of quantum physics recently. Just got finished reading Brian Greene's book, Hidden Reality. And if you haven't read that one, you have to. It's incredible. You start reading about some of these things, and they do explain, maybe not explain, they offer possible explanations, I think, for some of the things that we're considering to be paranormal events. It may very well be that they can be explained by science, but no physicist is going to risk his $1 million grant from the federal government to say, I'm studying ghosts, because he's not going to get that grant. The minute he says that, he's going to find himself out of a job. So they don't do it, and it's unfortunate. And I think the same thing with religion. I think there could be some closer correlation there, but I think religions are sort of hung up on their own little dogmas, whatever they may be, and aren't necessarily open to sort of broader explorations of those. So I think everybody's got to come together to help the poor paranormalists as they're out there working.
How funny that you would bring up Brian Greene. I interviewed him maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, when his series was on PBS, mm-hmm. I believe it was last, and went through discussing all the amazing topics that he was bringing up in the series and things that are just mind-boggling, and then kind of as an afterthought, I segued into the paranormal. And I'll tell you what, I was really surprised. He just shut down. I mean, it could not have been more a stereotype of what you were just talking about. It was like I had insulted his mother or something. I mean, it was as if I went from being a interesting conversationalist, to a blithering idiot. And it really, really it just stood out, because he was he's a real nice guy, interesting guy, not just a scientist, a cultural thinker and a conversationalist. But when I brought that up, boy, that was it. There is no evidence. There is no intersection between science and the paranormal. If and when there ever is any objective evidence, if there's any scientific reason to believe in an afterlife, I'll let you know. that was kind of the bottom line. So I thought that was quite closed-minded of him, actually. But it could be just what you just said. That's the pressures.
Of course. No one's going to do it. I mean, think about, the resistance to the theory that the world was flat. The minute people said, what do you mean? We can actually sail around it. Oh, man. Oh, no, I don't think so. And why? Because, you had an established church that believed that the resistance to the idea that the sun was the center of our solar system instead of the earth being the center of our system, with the planets, including the sun, revolving around it. And think of all the scientists that said, there's absolutely no grounds for this. We won't even study the idea that the sun, that we go around the sun. Then Copernicus says, well, I'll take a look at that, So, I mean, it's weird. It takes some kind of scientists are strange, because they always say that they're open to study and exploration and research. And yet you say, well, let's study ghosts. No, we're not going to do that. I mean, well, wait a minute. isn't science the idea of discovery, investigation? How do you just arbitrarily close down a subject and say it's not science worthy? I mean, why not?
It's so sad too that science has come so far and the paranormal has come so far. And yet it's so much more accepted than it was even 20, 30 years ago. And Lord knows it's more accepted than it was 50 or 100 years ago. But we still hit the brick wall with scientists. It's like they're almost afraid to be ridiculed and they won't study it. And I think it's very arrogant of them to think that they have all the answers when their science is all based on trial and error and a hypothesis. And then it changes. It's always changing. So the fact that they won't kind of take it more seriously is kind of a shame, and I think that's going to be a big brick wall as far as the paranormal ever moving forward in leaps and bounds scientifically. But I'm okay with that because, like you said, changing views on the paranormal, when I first got into organized ghost hunting or investigating, like in a group setting with other people, setting out to do it, not just on my own. I said it was a scientific approach and it's all about science and we're looking for real answers. And it's nothing we do is scientific. We use technology and we might apply a few basic scientific principles, but none of it can be recreated in a lab. You can't get the same results over and over. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's okay. I'm more about the personal experience, and because you can't take that away from somebody. And I think that people need to stop focusing on claiming to be scientific when they're really not. They really aren't. That's one of my pet peeves, all these teams that say they use a scientific approach. Not really, they don't. I mean, it would be great. I think that we're going to have some more developments in our field when we do get that one scientist who really maybe doesn't need the money and when we'll take that chance and look into it more in a more scientific setting. But in the meantime, I think that it's fascinating just the way it is. I don't think you need to really do that. I think you have to kind of take it with a leap of faith and just enjoy the ride. I think the mystery is what makes it so appealing. If they can scientifically prove ghosts, I think that a lot of people aren't going to be as interested in them anymore.
It may very well be.
I think it just takes the mystique away. What are ghosts? And just the way what fascinates me is how, I said it before, how different it is from culture to culture and country to country. What happens, here's a scientific experiment. What happens if, say, an American goes to another country where what they believe to be ghosts is completely different? Will they experience a spirit or a ghost the way that people that are native to that culture experience it? Or will they experience it the way that they expect to, the way that it is that we believe as Americans to perceive it? Does the experience change? Does the ghost change itself? I would love to take ghost hunters from America and throw them in another environment. Here's a show. In a completely different culture, and see if they experience spirits the way maybe the Japanese do, or maybe the way some other cultures do. I think that would be fascinating, and that's where you start thinking, it is a matter of perception, is it, or isn't it? Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Well,
hey,
and,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going back to Brian Greene, and not just him, but a lot of other, you know, physicists will tell you that the event, whatever the event is affected by the viewer, that the viewer has an effect on the event. So to your point, Teresa, you take an American and put him in Japan, whatever event he sees there, it's going to be affected by how he sees it as compared to his Japanese counterpart, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting.
I wanted to ask, since we are here all in Ohio, and wow. That was a super fast 53 minutes. It's really hard to believe. I'm interested in hearing what are a few of your really favorite paranormal locations in Ohio, and maybe tell a story or two regarding the Buckeye State.
The Buckeye State. Okay. Well, well, one of my favorites is actually one of the oldest, one of the first that I did, and that's the Collingwood Art Center in Toledo, Ohio, which was in my first book, Ghost Hunting Ohio. And what I liked about this one was that the people, it's the short story is that it used to be a college and eventually ended up becoming an art center where artists live and have their apartments and actual studios and everything else in this big building. And it's open to the public. They do, you know, art shows and things like that. I went up there on the advice of a psychic friend of mine and talked to some of the artists up there and did my investigation, kind of wandering around in the basement and everything else like that. And when I was down in the basement, what happened was I was walking down a hallway that was just basically, you know, dark for the most part, and I was by myself. And walking down through it, I sort of hit what I considered like a patch of thick air. It suddenly felt heavy. It felt dense. I mean, I was just walking down this hallway, and all of a sudden, it just felt very, very dense and dark and heavy, almost like somebody had thrown a wet blanket over me or something. And at the same time that that happened, I was aware of an emotional change. Like, psychologically, I suddenly felt this overwhelming sense of sadness, of depression. And I'm not normally, you know, Teresa can probably verify, I'm not a very depressive guy, you know. I might depress other people, but I'm not personally not a depressive guy, you know. But anyway, so I had this very strange visceral reaction, and I just kept walking. Within 2 feet or so, I walked through it. It lifted entirely, and it was so sudden and so shocking that I just literally turned around and looked over my shoulder thinking, what did I walk through, you know? But there wasn't anything there. But I would talk to the artists, and I said, so what's going on? What are you guys experiencing? And they talked about something they were calling Shadow Man. And they were calling, they said that they were seeing this life-size human figure that was just literally a black silhouette with no detail, like a big, you know, cut-out paper doll of black paper. And I said, well, where do you see it? And they said, well, we see it a lot in the basement. So I went down there with one of the artists, and he showed me the area, one of the areas where they see Shadow Man. And that was the area that I just walked through earlier. So I thought, wow, did I walk through something then? Did I walk through Shadow Man? You know, I don't know. I didn't see anything. But the interesting thing is they were talking about this being that they were seeing, this shadowy figure that they'd seen in the basement, or sometimes literally coming up the stairs of the basement. And I got their stories, and after I left, I got a call from the art director about a week later, and he told me that there were some retired Ursuline nuns that came to visit the center because it used to be an Ursuline college for girls. And they taught there when it was a college, and now that it was an art center, they wanted to see what it was like, so they asked the director if he'd give them a little tour, and he was happy to do that. So he took a little tour around the facility, and at the end, as they're about ready to leave, one of the nuns turns around and says to the director, he said, by the way, she said, is the shadow still in the basement? Yeah. Well, they hadn't been in that building in about 20 years, and nobody had written about this thing. I was the first person to write about it. It hadn't been in the newspapers or anything else like that. So what I like about this place is that you had a group of nuns who said, oh, yeah, we used to see that thing when we were here, you know, when we were teaching here, but 20 years earlier, you know, we used to see it in the basement. So the nuns saw it. The artists were seeing it 20 years later, and they were describing it, you know, separately in the same way. You know, you talk to the nuns, they said, oh, yeah, a black shadowy figure, we'd see it walking in the basement. And the artists would say the same thing. Now, you know, neither group had a chance to corroborate the other's story. And at the same time, you would think that if anybody should be telling the truth, it should be a nun. So, I mean, so that was a great place. I like that because there's this history, you know, we can't prove the existence of ghosts. None of that would stand up in a court of law. But when you get two disparate groups like that over a time period of 2 decades talking about the same experience and talking about it in the same way, you've got to say, well, something is happening there. You know, they're experiencing something, you know. So that's kind of one of my – I like that place in Ohio a lot. And then, you know, right here in Cincinnati, I like well, it used to be well, it still is a hotel, but it changed its name. It's now the Netherland Hilton Hotel. But they have what they call a lady in green here who has been seen by Delta Airline pilots who use this hotel as their stopover, layover place because Delta has a hub here at Cincinnati. So, You know, they're there. Airline pilots have seen her on the elevator, and she's a woman that apparently the story is that when this hotel was being built back in the 1930s, her husband was working on the job and apparently fell off a scaffold and was killed. So the night that they had the grand opening of this hotel, they had like a big reception and a big celebration in there. And she came to it sort of in memory of her deceased husband, you know. And she was wearing a green gown, like a ball gown. And that evening she attended the reception, and then apparently she booked a room upstairs, like I think on the 13th floor or something. And she went up to her room, opened the window, and threw herself out. And so they say that she is still there. And like I said, she's been seen on the elevators by pilots. She's seen by the concierge. I mean, a lot of people have seen this woman just, you know, hanging around the hotel. She is so notorious that the hotel itself, even in their little, they have a little pamphlet about the hotel because it's really this beautiful Art Deco building, and it's loaded with a lot of art from that time. They talk about her. The very last page says, by the way, we have a ghost here called the Lady in Green. So they advertise it. And I mentioned Delta Airline pilots because, again, like nuns, you know, maybe a pilot can lie, but you think of him as being somebody pretty rational, pretty level-headed, you know, and yet they admit to seeing her there too. So that's a favorite place. I mean, there's so many. I don't know. I'm trying to think of some other really good ones.
Have you had any? Have you done any research or heard any stories about Wittenberg University? That's where I went in Springfield. So that's pretty close to you down there.
Pretty close, yeah. No, you know, but I'll tell you, Eric, I deliberately stayed away from universities, as I also did from hospitals. I mean, you hear a lot of stories from hospitals too, but I didn't want to write about places that where it could cause a problem. I mean, if I wrote about a university that, you know, it could cause a problem and maybe a lot of people trying to get into the campus or trying to get into a dorm, you know, to check it out. And the same thing for hospitals. Obviously, people are going to hospitals for legitimate reasons. I didn't want to say, by the way, this hospital's haunted, you know. So I kept away from certain areas. But as you probably know, almost every college has has a ghost or two.
Oh, yeah.
Ohio University, you know.
It only makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I was teaching at Ohio University. And by the way, minor correction, it's not former. I'm still teaching there, but anyway.
Oh, my apologies.
Yeah. No, it's, well, you know what it is, Teresa. I'm teaching now in their distance learning program since I'm in Cincinnati. So, yeah. So, I mean, I'm not on campus, obviously. But, you know, I wrote about that place, but only because the building that I wrote about is kind of a separate building, and most of it is closed to the public anyway. You know, it's the Ridges in Athens, which is another great place. But anyway.
All right. Well, I guess we have gone past our time, as we always do. What a great conversation. It often, you know, usually when we're talking to people, it's kind of more like, you know, what do they have going on? We talk to a lot of the people affiliated with the various TV shows, and we're talking about the shows and what's coming up. So this was a really rare treat where we kind of got to discuss more of the underlying issues and how they all come together. And that, it was really fascinating. Really enjoyed speaking with you. Love to have you back on. And, wow, I have plenty to think about. Teresa, why don't you wrap things up?
Yeah, John, before we go, thank you, first of all, for being with us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait till I see you again. But let's tell everybody about your books and your e-books and what you have going on.
Sure,
and
sure,
how to follow you.
Well, I mean, the best thing is to go to my website, which is www.johncachuba.com, JohnKachuba. I think you've got that on your site anyway. But yeah, I mean, all my books are available. You know, they're still in the bookstores, so they're easily affordable and easy to get in the bookstores or on Amazon. The new fiction, The Dark Entry, which is a novel, and Ghost Stories, which is a very small collection of ghost stories, are both available as e-books only on Kindle. They're pretty inexpensive. They're cheap reads, so, you know, go ahead. As for what I'm doing, I mean, you know, things are starting to pick up already. Of course, the fall is big for me. I'm usually doing libraries and universities. But in fact, this weekend I'm speaking at a group called the Society for Rational Thought. So, yeah. Well, about a month ago, I spoke to the Southwest chapter of Mensa. So that was kind of
low now.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say the Society for Irrational Thought.
I know, right? No, they like to sort of shorthand it by calling themselves the skeptics. So, okay. So we'll see what I'll be up for on Saturday.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be fun. I'm sure it'll be interesting.
It will be. Yeah.
I'm sure you will convince one or two of a thing
we'll
or two
see.
And call it a victory.
Well,
all right. Well, have a great rest of your evening. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it. It was lots of fun. Always plenty more territory to cover, of course. And don't forget to join us on Twitter at AM Haunted, same with Facebook. And we are plugging away on the book. It's very exciting, lots of fun. We have a deal, for those who haven't heard, with Penguin. So we don't know exactly when it'll be coming out and hitting the real world, probably early 14, I'm guessing, just based on the way things are going. But we're making real good progress. It's really fun, really interesting, and we will be talking about the various places that we are covering as we go in America's Most Haunted. All right, have a great week, everybody, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday night at 10 Eastern. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.